Good evening, America. Welcome to the program. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman. Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks are on assignment. Joining me this evening are Dennis Merritt and Wayne Wright. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me, Sam.
Wayne, how you doing?
Good, Sam. Glad to be back.
Awesome. Glad you guys are able to join in this evening. Before we move on, let's do our disclaimer. We are not attorneys, and a Just Cause Coast to Coast does not provide legal advice, so please contact your personal legal advisor for your legal needs. Also, the opinions expressed by callers or guests do not necessarily reflect that of a Just Cause or a Just Cause Coast to Coast. But as always, thank you for tuning in and choosing to spend time with us this evening. As far as tonight's show, we're going to be talking about or asking the question, you know, why don't people get involved? And, you know, there is a lot of stuff that's going on in the news with regard to judicial injustice, police corruption, police abuse, and so forth.
Police killings.
And you know, people just don't get involved. And we've experienced that ourselves with the IRP 6 case. Now, you know, not taking away anything from the folks who have gotten involved, because we have had a lot of people, a lot of notable folks who have really taken up the cause for, along with a Just Cause on behalf of the IRP 6. But, you know, we still want to ask that question as to, you know, why are there so many people out there that don't get involved? And, you know, as we've talked about before on the program, it's as if it's not in my backyard, if it's not in my house, if it's not affecting me directly, then, you know, why should I get involved?
Right. And to get involved, it takes effort. You talk about the people that have joined in the fight for the IRP 6 freedom, and I look at the efforts of a Just Cause with all of the press releases, the radio shows, the letters, the calling campaigns. It took quite a lot of effort, you know, to get these folks on board and to hear. So I think one of the reasons people don't get involved is they're lazy.
Yeah, it takes work. It definitely takes work. Well, to help us talk about that subject are some guests that we're going to have on later in the program. We're going to have Gina McGill. Now, she's just a regular citizen who got so irritated, I would say, by the Trayvon Martin case that she wrote a book about it. And so she's going to come on a little bit later and talk about her book. And then she's also, you know, just going to talk from a standpoint of, you know, what made her get involved in that situation. Also, we have a retired judge, the Honorable Mary Bullock. She's going to be joining us a little bit later as well. And then a young man from Los Angeles, California, who is an independent documentary film producer. And his name is Mike Riley. He sent us an email about a week ago. And so we're going to have him come on, and he's doing some good things as far as, you know, getting the word out and you know, making people aware and trying to get folks to get involved. And he asked, you know, a question as far as, you know, as far as talking about the uninformed states of America. And so, you know, the USA. And so we're going to have Mike come on a little bit later in the program to talk about that. Our listeners, if you'd like to chime in on the conversation, you know, we'd like to hear from some of you. You know, why do you think people don't get involved? Or if you do get involved in a cause, or if you're advocating for a particular purpose with regard to judicial reform, give us a call. Our phone number is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. And, you know, before we go any further, we have to talk about the IRP 6 from the standpoint of where their case is right now. And we've talked before talking about how the IRP 6 were instrumental in getting a Just Cause started because of the situation of their case, where in 2003, IRP Solutions was launched. They were developing software for local, state, and federal law enforcement. In 2005, the company was raided by the FBI, with the company and the executives being accused of wrongdoing. When the IRP 6, Gary Walker, David Banks, Dave Zerpolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, and Demetrius Harper saw what was happening to them, they had to draw attention to this situation. So that birthed a Just Cause. But then it kind of morphed into where we are today, because of the fact that even then, they realized that the situation that the IRP six were in and IRP Solutions was not an isolated situation, but that it was happening to other people. So had to have a platform where everybody talk about it. So that's where, you know, A Just Cause came from. And folks can get more information about A Just Cause by going to www.a-justcause.com. Again, www.a-justcause.com. We also have a donate button on the website, so we would ask that you would help us out, because if you believe in what A Just Cause is doing, then, you know, give us a little bit of assistance there. Now,
right,
as far as the IRP 6 are concerned, we have archives out there at ajcradio.com where we talk about various aspects of the case. Today, as far as where the case is today, Attorney Gwendolyn Solomon, a couple of weeks ago, I believe it was on the 27th, we were notified a day or so after that, after Attorney Gwendolyn Solomon, the appellate attorney for the IRP 6, filed a motion, a writ of certiorari, I think I'm saying that right.
That sounds good to me.
I didn't take Latin, so those Latin terms will get you. But at any rate, it was docketed with the United States Supreme Court. So, you know, congratulations to Attorney Solomon. Hats off to her for sticking in there and hanging in there, you know, to get that through, because one of the appellate attorneys that was on the case, Mark Garagos, he, you know, did not do right by the IRP 6, not do right by the IRP 6 families. And, you know, when you have a man that takes $100,000 from families, and it's not just, you know, $100,000 that someone has laying around.
Right.
I mean, you got folks who, you got to ask friends and family and everybody to come together to make this happen, and did nothing. I mean,
yeah, that truly disappointed me. I was like, because here's this so-called legal rep that has this big power. You know, he's the best of the best. And then all he does is he comes and takes money. And then the way he treated the IRP 6, you know, over phone conversations and you know, treated them like they were dirt, like he wasn't even representing them.
Well, one phone conversation.
You know, one phone
conversation. Yeah, I mean,
but
that's the worst.
It's amazing to me how he could, you know, come in, you know, with the premises that he was there to help and then do nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Yeah, he was absolutely rude to the IRP 6 in his very first conference call with them. Even went to the point of hanging up on them. You know, and this is supposed to be a call where you're going to discuss strategy on, you know, what are we getting ready to do as far as filing this motion for bond pending appeal. He was also, you know, there to assist with the lawsuit whereby we were trying to get the transcript that, you know, that's been held up by Judge Christine mm-hmm. Arguello. You know, one of the violations that occurred with the IRP 6 kernel case. When, you know, during the trial, Judge Christine Arguello forced him to take the witness stand. The transcript pertaining to that has never been delivered.
That's
I mean,
amazing.
We requested unedited versions of it and the entire transcripts for that day. So we've gotten transcripts for October 11, 2011, but that part of the day's proceedings never been provided. So the lawsuit, you know, to try and compel the courts to deliver it, fell flat. And that, again, I have to point it back to Garagos because of the fact that he, when the civil case was filed, Judge R. Brooke Jackson had made a simple request. Go down to the clerk's office and see if this, you know, certain components are available. It does not take 2.5 months.
Mm.
To check that out.
No, and we're talking about a high-powered attorney that has a staff. The judge didn't say he had to go down himself. He could have sent someone. I mean, that's disgusting.
Well, and Wayne, actually, Attorney Solomon, she did go down. And I think it was either that same day or the next day. And found the information, or didn't find the information, because the information was not there, and had it ready to present. But it took over 2 months for them to reply back to Judge Jackson. So you have to know that Judge Jackson got upset because of the fact that you didn't reply in a timely manner. The judge himself went down and did some examination himself. So you know a federal judge is not going to like that either. So, you know, so we got the situation where the IRP6 have been incarcerated now for over 2 years, and you got the Fifth Amendment violation. You got expert witnesses that were not allowed to testify. You got a Sixth Amendment violation, which is part of that. You got the speedy trial violation. All of these things are part of the petition that Gwendolyn Solomon filed with the United States Supreme Court. So, you know, we're expecting to hear some word back on that. We put out a press release today regarding additional information about the Sixth Amendment violation and the situation with the expert witnesses not being allowed to testify. Now, you can go out to prweb.com and check out that press release, or, again, you can go to a-justcause.com and check out that press release. A lot of that was written by the facts and the research was done by David Banks, one of the IRP6. And he clearly articulates the law and case law as to how when U.S. Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch basically objected to Andrew Alberelli, the expert witness, taking the stand. Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch based that on what he called a Rule 16 violation. Well, David Banks finds out through his research that there was no Rule 16 violation because of the sequence of events that had occurred, that if the government had taken certain action, then IRP6 would have had to take certain action. Then that would have opened the door for this Rule 16 thing.
Right.
But the and then also part of that is that the government claims that they didn't know that they were going to testify as expert witnesses. All of that is bogus. All of it is bogus.
Yes.
And David articulated so well that there was no Rule 16 violation. Therefore, Federal Judge Christine Arguello should not have allowed the Assistant U.S. Attorney's objection to stand, which would have then led to Andrew Alberelli taking the stand and testifying to the fact that the way IRP was conducting business was legitimate. It was consistent with the industry. So now, that being said, and this is why Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch did not want Andrew Alberelli to take the stand. And so, you know, on July 18th, 2011, that's months before the trial,
months,
Andrew Alberelli sends a letter to John Walsh, the U.S. Attorney in Denver, Colorado, kind of laying out his credentials and, for all practical purposes, stating that IRP Solutions is doing business legitimately. And it's nothing illegal about the way IRP Solutions is doing business.
Absolutely. I mean, you just look at some of his credentials. He was in staffing for 15 years. He's the principal executive officer of Remy Corporation, a honorably discharged military veteran, co-president of the Oracle Mountain States Users Group. The one that I think really brings his
credentials.
Thank you. I was struggling with that.
That's all right.
Is that he worked with the FBI on the investigation of the InfraGuard for almost 9 years. He assisted them in an investigation of false network of candidates interviewing bait and switch with staffing firms. I mean, that was the whole case for the U.S. government.
Now, can you
imagine?
He
would have blown that out of the water.
Yes. Can you imagine if the jurors would have had heard him, if he would have been able to testify? I guarantee you that the jurors would have looked at this case a lot differently.
And they dealt with him very prejudicially in the trial. I mean, they allowed him to take the stand, and then they removed him. So the jurors are left wondering, well, who is this guy, and why isn't he being allowed to testify? What's wrong with him?
Absolutely, and the thing is, when
that
you
didn't look good,
it didn't, and it makes you wonder. You know, if you're sitting there on a jury, it's like, so why was that guy there,
exactly.
And what was he going to talk about? You know, and if I were a juror, I think that would make me scrutinize even more so as to what was going on. And so, for Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch to just object to him being there, and then Judge Arguello agreeing to that, and she said in her own words, Judge Arguello said in her own words, that I know that these witnesses are critical to your case.
Mm-hmm.
How can you say that
and not allow
it? And then not allow it?
Amazing.
Well, if my goal is for you not to have a fair case and to wrongfully convict you, that's how it happens.
Yeah, yeah. It's like if the goal is to railroad you, then, hey, I got the ticket right here. Here's your train ticket. And got to be sure that I punch every hole on this ticket to be sure that you are on that train. And so, you know, that's just one of the examples of of some of the things that went awry in the IRP 6 case where it all of it reeks
mm-hmm.
of injustice, corruption, just not a fair trial.
No.
The word conspiracy, you know, no one wants to use it. But when you look at the IRP 6 case, you can't but come up with conspiracy. It's so many entities involved in this case that did everything possible to make sure these men were found guilty of something. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And the way you look at it, no one can tell me that there ain't something going on undercover with this case.
Absolutely. And so, you know, we've given little bits of different aspects of the case. And like I said, go out to justcause.com to check out the latest press release. Go out to PR Web, check out the latest press release, all of the press releases, actually. But as far as the one part that we talked about where Judge Arguello made Kendrick Barnes take the stand and that part of the transcript being missing or not being delivered, it's not missing, it's somewhere.
Right.
But we are fighting, continuing in the fight to ask Attorney General Eric Holder to look into this.
Exactly.
And because of the fact that and then also, you know, the assistant U.S. attorney, Matthew Kirsch, he has an obligation
as an officer of the court.
Absolutely. From a professional conduct perspective to say what happened at that sidebar. He knows what happened. And he knows that something occurred that has not been accounted for.
Right. There's been affidavits by the IRP 6, by Gwendolyn Solomon. Nothing from the U.S. Attorney's Office as to what happened in that sidebar.
That's right. That's right. And so as far as the U.S. Attorney, Attorney General Eric Holder's office, we're asking him to look into that. So, Dennis, what are we asking our listeners to do as far as helping us out on that?
Yeah, listeners, we're asking you guys to go out and reach out to the Attorney General's Eric Holder's office. His number is 202-514-2003 or 202-514-2005. We want you to give him a call. Ask his office to investigate the IRP 6 case. Let him know how you feel. I mean, we're trying to get him on board to look at this case because I'm telling you, this is seriously a wrongful conviction. We would truly appreciate you do that for us.
And then also, as far as the missing transcript pertaining to the conference, the sidebar conference, we have a petition out on change.org. Again, that's change.org. Do a search on IRP 6 and sign that petition. Ask others to sign that petition as well. Send out links to family and friends and ask them to take a look at that. For more information about the IRP 6, go to freetheirp6.org. Again, freetheirp6.org. Again, keep our brothers in prayer. The IRP 6 are Gary Walker, David Banks, Dave Zerpolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, and Demetrius Harper. For more information about programming for a Just Cause Coast to Coast, you can go to ajcradio.com. You can also catch us 24/7 at live365.com. And then for your day-by-day, blow-by-blow updates as far as what's happening with the Just Cause or what's happening with the IRP 6, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Our phone number this evening, 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back in a moment.
Your friend from drinking and driving, you're as good as dead.
drinking and driving can kill a friendship.
Congress
shall make no law
respecting an establishment
of religion
or prohibiting the free exercise
thereof
or abridging the freedom of speech
or of the press
or the right
of the people
peaceably
to assemble
and to petition
the government
for a redress of grievances.
Join a just cause in the fight against wrongful convictions, judicial injustice, misconduct, and corruption. Contact us at 855-529-4252 or at www.a-justcause.com.
We have a big problem, and we need your help.
It's happening on college campuses, at bars, at parties, even in high schools.
It's happening to our sisters and our daughters,
our wives, and our friends.
It's called sexual assault, and it has to stop. We have to stop it. So listen up.
If she doesn't consent, or if she can't consent, it's rape, it's assault.
It's a crime. It's wrong.
If I saw it happening, I was taught you have to do something about it.
If I saw it happening, I speak up.
If I saw it happening, I'd never blame her. I'd help her.
Because I don't want to be a part of the problem. I want to be a part of the solution.
We need all of you to be part of the solution. This is about respect. It's about responsibility.
It's up to all of us to put an end to sexual assault. And that starts with you.
Because one is too many.
Hey guys, I'm Jordan Sparks.
I'm Chase Crawford.
Hey, what's up? It's Usher.
Hi, I'm Rachel Bilson.
I'm Hayden Christensen.
I'm Peyton Manning.
Hey, we're Fall Out Boy.
I'm Jared Archuleta.
I'm Corbin Blue.
I'm Kristen Bell.
And we're the Jonas Brothers.
Do something good for your community.
Reuse bags and bottles and always recycle.
Help us collect 1 million pounds of food.
Help people prepare for natural disasters.
Do something about homelessness.
Anyone could be a rock star in their community.
So then do something.
Do something.
Do something.
Do something.
Visit dosomething.org to find out how.
You are listening to KJZ Radio.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our phone number, 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. I'm Sam Thurman, being joined by Dennis Merritt and Wayne Wright, in for Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks, who are all on assignment. Welcome again, Dennis and Wayne.
Hey, good to be here.
Thanks, Sam.
Hey, did you guys hear about this shooting that occurred in Saratoga Springs, Utah?
Yes,
what a tragedy.
I mean, this is sad. I mean, it's our black men, our black youth, if you will. I mean, I think we're all of age where we can call a 22-year-old black youth, a young black man shot again, killed in the streets, and he had a, for all practical purposes, a toy sword.
It's getting ridiculous. I mean, I want to read this. This is deadly force before we go into this story. It says, deadly force as defined by the United States Armed Forces is the force which a person uses, causing or that a person knows or should know would create a substantial risk of causing death, seriously bodily harm, or injury. In most jurisdictions, the use of deadly force is justified only under conditions of extreme necessity as a last resort. When all lesser means have failed or cannot reasonably be employed. It's amazing to me how we got all these kids getting killed and no one's trying to maim them. No one's trying to bring them down. It's just straight up kill them.
Well, that's because the purpose of a lynching is to kill the black man, not to arrest him.
That's ridiculous. I mean, I'm just not getting it.
Yeah, and you know, and here, you know, there are articles posted everywhere about this case, and on MSN.com as well as The Guardian, their articles. And, you know, in The Guardian, they even say, as of today, there's an article here that says the chief of police is saying that they have yet to even interview the two police officers that were involved. Now, that was, you know, earlier today. Hopefully something has happened today. But they have yet to interview the two police officers. And if you see the photo of this, I was telling you guys earlier, you know, when I saw it on CNN, you know, Darian was standing there in front of a police car. Two police officers are, you know, standing on either side of him, you know, probably, what, 10 feet away on mm-hmm. each side? Yet the report is that he lunged at them. But then what does the autopsy say, Dennis?
The autopsy says that he was running away from them when he got shot.
There were 6 bullet wounds in his back.
Wow.
And they had an independent autopsy done on that.
Well, he must have been doing some crazy spinning kung fu up in the air, turning around to get shot 6 times in the back.
Well, and you know, they said that they got a report, and this was on last Wednesday, got a report of a suspicious man walking near businesses along Redwood Road. This is in Saratoga Springs, carrying a samurai-type sword. But then, you know, his mother says that it was basically a fake. It was not a real weapon. It didn't have a blade.
It
didn't have a blade.
It had a rounded edge. Bought it at a souvenir shop.
Yeah.
Why was he suspicious? Probably because he was black.
Well, and you know, his mother had just gone through a divorce from her husband. She says that, you know, he was still dealing with some of that. But still, he's walking down the street. Now, here's what his mother said during one of the interviews. She said that they killed my son because he's black. No white boy with a little sword would they shoot while he's running away. Now, you know, that's probably any mother who has lost their son, especially in a situation like this, has that feeling that, you know, they killed my son because he's black.
Right.
Now, for those who are not familiar with the story, here's the twist. She's white.
Exactly. Exactly.
And these same sentiments were shared by her mother as well, who said they killed my grandson because he's black.
Exactly. So Mrs. Hunt, her husband, was African-American. So Darian was, you know, the product of their marriage. But, you know, to have a white mother on national television saying they killed my son because he's black, I want to see how the world deals with this one. Because, you know, that is, up to this point, they've seen, you know, entire African-American communities, Ferguson, Missouri, coming out, Michael Brown. You have the case in New York. But in this situation, you have a young black man who's killed by the police. His mother is white, his grandmother is white, and saying, you killed our son because he's black.
I think it's going to bring the races together. I really do. I think everybody's going to start looking at it and saying, hey, enough is enough. I mean, we're tired of our children getting shot for no reason, all because a police officer has a trigger finger, a happy trigger finger, and just want to just shoot somebody. So I think it's going to bring awareness to the community, to the Americans as a whole. I mean, this issue has to be dealt with, and it needs to be dealt with now.
Well, and the fact is, no kid should be gunned down in the streets of America.
No.
So let's make that clear.
Exactly.
You know, we are not saying, you know, well, if it was a white kid that got killed under those kind of situations, we'd be talking about the
same
thing.
Exactly.
Still the same.
Unfortunately, a lot of those in America don't mm-hmm. see it that way. It's like sometimes it's just, oh, well, just another black guy, you know.
And it happens.
I'm being very polite in the way I'm saying that.
It happens so often. I read a study in 2012, and it said every 28 hours, a black man is killed in an extrajudicial killing. That's a nice way of saying he's killed by a police officer or a security guard. That was 313 black men and boys killed in 2012. And so, Dennis, like your statement, I hope it does bring awareness. I'm not optimistic because it has become so common that every time I hear about a black man being shot, I have to look at the name to see if it's a different one or the one I heard about last week, because every week there's one in the news.
Well, until America, I mean, until we come together as a nation and start, you know, really talking about the injustice in this country, we're going to continue to have police doing what they want to do. So I think we, the biggest thing is we got to come together and we got to face the fact that America has a problem when it comes to justice.
It does.
Now, let's get ready for our first guest. And, you know, this is the story about Trayvon Martin. Goes right along the same line that we were talking about a moment ago, which, you know, there's also another story in the news on that one. George Zimmerman is in the news again telling someone that he's going to kill him. Mm-hmm. You know, and how many times does this guy have to be in the news before they realize that he is really there's a problem with this man? And either he is going to kill someone again in cold blood,
or
and I say again because
him.
Of the fact that he killed exactly. Trayvon Martin in cold blood, or someone's going to kill him.
Exactly.
And so, you know, they need to get this man under control. Well, there is a young lady who has written a book about the Trayvon Martin case. And, you know, as we talked about at the top of the program, tonight we're talking about why don't people get involved? You know, why don't people step up and get involved, whether it's at the grassroots level from an advocacy perspective or even when they see an injustice taking place? Step up. When you know that an injustice takes place in the courtroom, Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, step up and say what you saw. When you, you know, see police corruption and abuse, step up. Well, Gina McGill, she's written a book about the Trayvon Martin case. She's just an average citizen who stepped up. So let's bring her onto the program. Ms. McGill, how are you doing this evening?
I'm fine. Yourself?
We are doing great. Welcome to the program. Thanks for taking time out of your evening to join us. So the book that you've written on the Trayvon Martin case, State of Florida versus Trayvon Martin, what made you decide to sit down and author this book?
Well, I heard his yells for help, and that really disturbed me. And also the fact that the police accepted Zimmerman's story as truth was an insult to me. So I had to do something about it.
So now, you were previously a computer programmer, an IT business analyst, got a degree in chemistry, and then a master's in science and environmental science. And so you left that career to write this book. Is that correct?
Well, I didn't leave it. I have time off, and so I spent that time dedicated to writing this book. It needed to be written, and it was part of a healing process for myself.
What kind of responses have you gotten on it so far?
Well, I've gotten great responses. The people have learned many things they had not heard before. Some have confirmation. And then on the other end, you know, there are people who will not look at the facts regardless. And so they're just determined that he's innocent. So it's been that spectrum.
Can you tell us about some of the things that you uncovered in your research that the average listener wouldn't know about this case?
Well, yes. It appears that Zimmerman, he was not alone. There are at least two or three other people with him, and I believe one of those was a law enforcement officer. And they had been tracking Trayvon Martin for at least probably about a half an hour before Zimmerman even called. And I say track because it was like they were hunting. Also, the first person Trayvon saw, he said that the man was looking at him at the mailbox, most likely was not Zimmerman. And I also talk about the witness statements of things that were not revealed in the news and by the police or even during the trial. I also point out where the prosecutor made untrue statements and provide information, factual information, to point that out. And also where the police accepted Zimmerman's story as true, I provide the facts to show that many of those things were impossible to have occurred, so that people will see the truth for what it is.
Now, we did get some excerpts from your book, and one of them that I was looking at was talking about the relationship of the Sanford Police Department and African Americans. Can you tell us what you uncovered between the Sanford Police Department and the black community?
Yes, well, first off, I would say that the Jim Crow laws didn't actually stop being enforced there until the mid-1980s. So the attitude there is still pretty strong. The black residents in Sanford have no trust in the police whatsoever. They said that Trayvon Martin is one of many who has been killed, and the police have not done their due diligence and upheld justice to make sure the suspect or attacker is brought to justice. There are many cases, one with Sherman Ware, who's a homeless man, who was punched in the back of his head by the son or the grandson of a police officer. And he was never arrested, even though the entire occurrence was recorded on video. And the police did not act on it. It took an outcry and a sharing of that video to finally get some response from the police on that. So black males in Sanford are discriminated against, and, you know, their lives are in danger. They are not valued whatsoever.
No, I've noticed not only in Sanford, but in a lot of instances when the victim is a black male, he's demonized in the public. They'll bring up if he's had any run-ins with the law. They try to make it almost as if it was justified in killing.
I still don't get how that the police could have told him, Zimmerman, just don't do nothing. Just stay where you're at. He go and he does his own thing, end up in a death, of course. And still, he gets off free. I would never understand that. Never.
Well, in the book, I do talk quite a bit about that. And it's, you know, it's due to institutional racism and racism as a whole, stereotyping of black men, devaluing them. And so they're seen as not deserving the same rights, you know, as non-blacks. And so it's okay. They feel justified and okay in treating them poorly.
That's a shame.
All right, Gina, we got to take a quick break. If you hang tight for us just for a couple of minutes, and we're going to come back and talk just a little bit about your book entitled State of Florida versus Trayvon Martin. Joining us is Gina McGill, author and activist. And she is just your normal citizen who wrote a book about the Trayvon Martin case. And our topic for tonight's program is, you know, why don't people get involved? And people need to get involved in these types of situations. This is the Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our phone number this evening is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. We'll be right back in a moment. Don't go anywhere.
Racism
has no place in sport.
No place in sport.
Everyone.
Everyone deserves a fair go. Regardless of skin colour,
background,
or culture.
Racism!
Racism! It stops with me.
It stops with me.
It stops with me.
With me. With me.
With me.
Racism! It stops with me.
1 in 5 of us are affected.
10% of us will have at least one.
And the number's double for Indigenous Australians.
Just as quick as a click of your fingers, it can happen to anyone at any time.
What would you do if someone close to you was having a seizure?
Imagine if it was your child.
My brother has it.
My sister has it.
I have it.
I have it too.
You're not alone.
You're not different.
And you have a bright future ahead of you.
So click for kids.
I'm Amy Lee, and I'm part of it.
You are listening to AJ Radio.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our phone number is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. And joining us is Gina McGill, and she is an author and activist. She has written a book about the Trayvon Martin case. Welcome again, Gina. Gina, there's one section in the book here that, you know, kind of, we talk about people getting involved, but then I guess people can get involved in the wrong way. And there's a section in your book that talks about criminal justice connections. And it talks about all the connections that that Zimmerman had. Kind of outline that for us and tell us, you know, it's kind of obvious, but I want to hear it from you as to what's wrong with this picture? So in that section where you talk about criminal justice connections and his father and so forth.
Okay, yes. Well, Zimmerman's best friend works in law enforcement as a federal air marshal. And Zimmerman's father is a retired judge. And I think he also has a cousin who's a police officer. I've heard very little about him, though. And then, of course, he had connections prior to the killing with officers at the Sanford Police Station. So he was known and he was liked. And I believe he received a great deal of help from his best friend, who also used to work with the Seminole County, which is the county that Sanford is in, with the police officers there. And his best friend also knows that ex-chief of police that had to resign as a result of this killing. So, it really helped him to know different people. Unfortunately, it should not have been that way. But it really looks like there was an obstruction of justice.
And like I said, you know, sometimes people get involved in the wrong way. And when you look at that, it just raises red flags all over the place. I mean, when you have a father who is a magistrate judge, you have friends who are in law enforcement, and, you know, I got to go back to our phrase that we use, that we're not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. So we know that there are good people who sit on the bench. We know that there are good prosecutors, people who take their job seriously. There are good defense attorneys. there are good law enforcement officers.
Exactly.
But then there are the others that are intermingled in there, and you know you gotta think that something is wrong here. That someone would, like you said in your book, Gina, there was some coaching going on. There was probably even a little bit of, you know, hallway negotiating going on. And so, you know, all that kind of stuff just raises red flags. And like I said before, you still have a dangerous man that's out there on the street in Zimmerman. I mean, when you have someone that pulls up to someone else and just does not like the way you're driving and say, I'm going to kill you,
mm-hmm.
something's wrong with that. Let's go to the phones. We have Mary Neal joining us. Mary, welcome to the program. You have a question or comment?
Well, thank you very much. I want to congratulate your author there, because the written word is very important, especially today when there's so much cyber stalking going on. When you have a book, an actual hardback book, you have something that cannot be changed by cyber stalkers. And I want to say that my name is Mary Neal. I'm Director of Assistance to the Incarcerated Mentally Ill. And I just wanted you to know at this station in your audience that Amy, that's Assistance to the Incarcerated Mentally Ill, is preparing a lawsuit that will be taken to international court. And that is Amy versus USA. And we're challenging America regarding how the mentally ill are continually shot down in our streets, killed behind bars without any accountability. We're challenging the way the homeless are rounded up and incarcerated simply for living. We're challenging all of that, and we're getting restitution, if God grants it, for our 100 families who are going before international court. And we're also taking 100 families who've been negatively impacted by rules that say people cannot be enforced into treatment until they're a danger to self and others. I want our taxpayers to know they're the others. So they're deliberately leaving mentally ill people on our streets without treatment, denying treatment to plenty of them, and drug alcohol abusers, until they prove by hurting someone that they're a danger. And that is because this United States government is basically run by prison investors. And so please look it up online, Amy, A-I-M-I, versus USA. And feel free to join if you fit either class. Thank you very much.
All right, that's Mary Neal. And, you know, we are talking about folks getting involved in. You know, Mary is a friend to Just Cause. She has called him before, and we've actually had Mary on the program as a guest as well, and she speaks from firsthand experience. If I recall correctly, it was a situation regarding her brother. And so if folks can go out there and check out Amy versus USA. Thanks for the call, Mary. Gina, on the book, how did you go about doing your research for this? It had to be, you know, painstaking, time-consuming. How did you go about doing your research to gather all the information that you say, you know, other people won't do and have not done?
Okay, before I answer that question, I would also like to, you brought up coaching earlier, and I would like to say that Zimmerman was not alone when he spoke to the dispatcher that night. He did have someone helping him and coaching him on what to say. Near the end of the call, you can hear him asking someone if they have a light. Also, at near the beginning of the call, you can hear Trayvon Martin actually speaking, asking either Zimmerman or the friend with him if there was a problem. And there was no response from Zimmerman's end, oral response. So I want that to be clear there. As far as doing this work, it was an extremely heavy workload. I did not realize how much work it would be. I basically spent almost a year averaging about 60 hours a week. Working on this, researching, pulling the documents from the police stations and the prosecutor, having to read through all those, not just once or twice, but again and again, and listening to recordings and watching videos. And it was a great deal of work. I almost actually stopped at 2 points, but then I remembered I made this promise to Trayvon that I would do it, and so I completed it.
And were you in contact, or have you been in contact with Trayvon's parents? And if so, what kind of contribution, you know, as far as information did they make to the book?
Actually, I did not talk to anyone. I was so frustrated with the false information out there, I decided to just strictly go with primary source material. And that's what I did. I have not spoken with his parents, but I do hope they are aware of the book.
Was it difficult?
I would certainly like them to have a copy.
I'm sorry. Was it difficult for you to get the information? You know, did you get a lot of kickback where there's a lot of unwillingness to give you the information that you were looking for?
Actually, no, because the police were required to release information, including that, you know, 911 recording and Zimmerman's phone recording with the dispatcher. So a lot of that was posted on various sites on the Internet, and I was able to retrieve it that way. And there's a very good group called Axiom Amnesia who went about collecting all of the documents regarding that case so that others interested could have a place to locate them. And I relied on them heavily.
Wow, because you would think with the information that you provide in your book, that would have been enough to definitely show Zimmerman as a as a murderer versus you know, somebody that didn't do anything, that was being, you know, actually, you know, the one that, you know, was on the other end.
Well, you know, Dennis, I think it's one of those things too where, like we always say, you know, people are going to see what they want to see.
True.
And if they don't want to see the truth, then they're going to put the blinders on. And then for those who don't want to ensure that others see the truth, then they're going to ensure that it doesn't get out there. So, you know, it's one of those things where, like in Gina's situation, you know, she dug for the truth and is now sharing that with others. Our guest this evening is Gina McGill. She's an author and activist, wrote a book entitled State of Florida versus Trayvon Martin. And Gina, I believe folks can find you on the web at Gina McGill. That's M-C-G-I-L-L. So GINAMCGILL.com, and they can find out information on how to order the book or download the book. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, Gina, thank you for joining us. Thank you for the work that you've done in helping to get the Trayvon Martin story out there. And we will post information on how folks can get in contact with you on our website. Again, thank you. And for our listeners, you can get archives of the interview with Gina McGill at ajcradio.com.
Talk,
thank
news,
you all as
politics,
well.
And inspiration.
All right, let's move on to our next guest. Our next guest is the Honorable Judge Mary E. Bullock. And Judge Bullock has presided over equal employment opportunities type cases. She has been a chief trial litigator in a law firm, a professor at San Diego School of Peace and Justice. She has been a professor of business law. Welcome to the program, Your Honor. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for asking, and thank you for having me on the show. It's been very interesting so far.
Well, I know that you're gonna add more to that to the excitement of the program, and hopefully our listeners will learn some additional information from the bench perspective. And, you know, one of the questions I want to start off with is, in the years that you spent on the bench, and again, keeping in mind with our subject matter this evening as to why don't people get involved, I know that you've probably seen all types of scenarios, all types of situations where people could step up, get involved, but they don't. What do you think that comes from?
You know, it comes from the fact that people see what has happened to their colleagues, another employee who actually stood up when something happened to them, did the right thing at the right time for the right reason. Perhaps they were aware of the possible consequences, and perhaps they were not. But nonetheless, they became, and the agency makes them, or the court makes them, an example of this is what will happen to you. Jobs is the hottest four-letter word in America. If you want yours, you won't stand up and say anything.
Wow. So, and from a employment perspective, obviously, you know, people are going to be hushed about things that they may be knowledgeable of. And I would venture to say, you know, from a criminal perspective or even in civil court, would you say that people, that there's this psychological block that prevents people from getting involved?
They don't want to get involved. They will tell you that. In a criminal case in particular, they'll tell you, I don't want to get involved. Because the fallout seems very apparent, especially if they, which a lot of people today, since we don't have a middle class, I mean, basically live on the edge. And it doesn't take much for people to lose their footing, which means lose their day-to-day existence.
And you know,
when you have... I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
No, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I would say when you have people who can no longer have a roof over their head or shoes on their children's feet and milk for them to drink, you have some serious problems.
Well, and, you know, when we come back, Judge, we have to take a quick break. But when we come back, let's talk a little bit more about that. I've come across this information about a phenomenon that's known as social psychological situation regarding bystander apathy. And so, you know, let's talk a little bit about that when we come back and different scenarios where that may present itself. Joining us this evening is the Honorable Judge Mary E. Bullock. And she is a retired federal judge. This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. This evening, we're talking about why people don't get involved. So, callers, if you'd like to join in on this conversation, if you'd like to get involved in the conversation, our phone number is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere.
Thanks for listening to AJC Radio. Call in at 347-838-8976 and share your stories and comments about judicial injustice. Be a part of the AJC Radio Show every Tuesday and Thursday night, 6 p.m. Mountain, 8 p.m. Eastern. The number again, 347-838-8976 or www.blogtalkradio.com and search for A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
The federal government targeted. Prosecutors convicted six executives and held back evidence.
Come on.
Hundreds of pages of missing manuscripts. Court circuit, 10th district denying the writ of mandamus. Free the RP6, critical rights violations, scandalous. Their motivation to finish their business with major companies, the government, New York PD, DHS, potential customers.
Come on.
Faith attempt to obtain funding from banks and angel investors with no success. That calm mail down, finance skeptics so they hire a staff that comes to fill the gap with every attention to fulfill the contract, fill the deal when money come back. Everybody paid the bills, the wages, take care of all of that. No Friday, they got viable software, but you prepare them to those with nothing to offer. Prosecuted by the attorney's office before the FBI gotta start investigating charges, skipping steps in the process, even barring the testimony of Andrew Alvarez, a witness who could tell why any staffing company that could do a Dunbar Street credit check would stick out their neck. If there was no prospect they could collect when they're reeling the net, it all relates to Harvey Silver's late statements about the vagueness of federal law, judicial chaos, A_justcause. Read the RP6.org, 347-205-9620, just blog. It's just us, but we don't gotta just talk. We can just march to the courts for the cause with one voice. It's just free them all.
Come on.
Picture this, a 75-year-old man convicted of murder waiting for his trial to finally go through. He's been on death row for 25 years now and finds out he's been wrongfully convicted and is completely innocent. Not only does this mean that 25 years of his life have been spent in jail for no reason, but that the actual murderer could still be out there right now. The bad thing is that this exact thing happens more often than you think, but you can help stop it by supporting our campaign to abolish the death penalty.
When does it stop being partly cloudy and start being partly sunny? Why is the word abbreviation so long? Are English muffins just muffins in England? Why is it called a washing line and not a drying line? Do fish get thirsty? If ghosts can walk through doors, why don't they fall through floors? Do you yawn when you sleep? If prunes are dried plums, how do they make prune juice? Why do doctors leave the room when you change? They're going to see you naked anyway. Do bald chefs wear hairnets? How much deeper would the ocean be if all the sponges were taken out? Do you believe someone who says they're a chronic liar? Why is sandwich bread square and sandwich meat round? Life's full of hard questions. Ask one more. You might just save a life.
Talk, news, politics, and inspiration.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Wayne Wright and Dennis Merritt, in for Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks, who are on assignment. Joining us right now is Mary Bullock, retired federal judge, the Honorable Mary E. Bullock. And we're talking this evening about why people don't get involved. And the judge has been, she's the author of Judging Me, and then also a radio program host. She has been the chief trial litigator in a law firm, as well as a professor of law. Again, welcome to the program, Judge Bullock.
Thank you.
So, Judge, when I think about jury trials, and or even if folks, you know, in a jury case, like a criminal case, if folks have an opportunity to step forward and they don't, you know, there's a phenomenon that's referred to as bystander apathy. And I would have to think that there is a little bit of self-preservation that comes into play when people don't get involved. Would that be your experience?
I think absolutely. That's the only reason. Why else would you not come forward about something so important? Because the consequences of not speaking up are so severe to those who are left to just hang.
Yeah, I think it's also...
And they see that.
Yeah. Go ahead, Dennis.
Yeah, I think it's also ignorance. I mean, citizens, I mean, we as citizens, we need to know law. It seems as though until law is affecting our life, until our rights are being violated, it's like out of sight, out of mind. So I think it's education too. We need to be made aware as a people, and we need to start looking for that awareness. What do you think about that, Judge?
Well, I think that's true, and the only problem I have with that, and it's conflicting, is that if 85% of the population does not trust the federal government, then why don't they come forward? They've lost their homes. They've lost, I mean, the Joe Lunch buckets, the middle class. They've lost their ability to live their life in a fairly predictable way. And you seriously have to turn your back on that willingly and walk away without doing anything about it. And you know what you're doing. You just choose the easier road.
Exactly.
Now, that's my belief. I don't believe that people are dumber than a box of rocks or dense or obtuse. I don't believe that at all.
Not at all.
No, you're right. I think when people see the consequences, if I bust someone in the nose and I say, if anyone else has something to say, I have a knuckle sandwich for you, most people are going to say, well, I don't want to get hit. I think one of the disappointing things about this, the lack of confidence in our government, is the lack of accountability that we see. So if we as, you know, the average everyday citizens are being oppressed by the government, you know, we're looking for someone inside of government that can help. As a litigator, a judge, you know, how often did you see in court someone standing up for things that were done wrong in trials?
Well, in the trials that I had, I mean, I was pretty forthcoming, and if they didn't, how shall I say, on cross-examination or direct, ask the proper questions, I did.
Okay.
And people were pretty truthful on the stand. However, I will tell you, the defendants are hardly ever truthful, in all due respect. But then you have something which we call veracity and credibility that a judge can absolutely tell when someone is lying. Or at least he's trained to be able to do that.
Oh, wow. Trained to be able to lie. And you know, Judge,
no,
I know
trained to be able to spot a liar.
Oh, gotcha. Oh, okay. Okay. And Judge, you said something there that kind of raised my eyebrows a little bit. And you said that defendants will lie. I mean, is that kind of a carte blanche?
It's about money. It's no. Well, let me just say, I don't want to pay. There's not an always here. So let me just start with the fact that I may use a broad brushstroke, but that does not imply always in everyone. It's a broad brushstroke that says, you know, it's the majority. It's the way of the times.
And you're talking from an EEO claims perspective?
I'm talking about being a chief litigator in the highest courts dealing with Department of Justice who would lie bald-faced to the judge who I would have to go, oh, wow, what a whopper, Your Honor. Let me show you the, document. And where the judge didn't care. He was a DOJ. Once he knows they lie, he didn't care.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay. So I guess it depends on who's sitting in that defense chair.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, I think you some information regarding the IRP 6 case was shared with you. And so in that situation, you have six, you know, gentlemen who defended themselves pro se. And here's a situation, we were talking about it earlier in the program, where the IRP 6 were trying to put a expert witness on the stand. And the government prosecutor, the assistant U.S. attorney, Matthew Kirsch, objected to it. And the judge sustained the objection. Yet there was no basis for it. I mean, this is the court is supposed to be about seeking justice. And so when you said that, you know, if a person asks a question the wrong way, you clarify it. You make sure that everyone in that courtroom understands what's going on. In this situation, it was as if there was not. That justice was not being sought. That when you talk about innocent until proven guilty, this was a classic example of we're going to get a conviction regardless of what you bring forward. And so under a Rule 16, which was not appropriately applied, the expert witness was dismissed. Now, when you look at a situation like that, and you ask, you know. Again, going back to our question, people get involved. Here you have a principal executive officer in a corporation, Andrew Alberelli, principal executive officer of Remy Corp, was going to take the stand and say that these six men were conducting business legitimately, they had a legitimate software, and there was nothing wrong with the way they were doing business.
Mm-hmm.
How can something like that happen in today's courts, Judge?
You know what? No one has asked the question, and perhaps I just haven't seen it yet, but what they, in terms of their software, what they were doing was of great value. Have you ever thought that there's a competitor?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, the amalgam of peculiar circumstances is so outrageous that, you know, anyone's conscience cannot sit there and say simply a procedural error. No. This is gross, outrageous conduct beyond what happens in a civilized society, let alone a civilized courtroom. So I have to ask and answer the question, who are the competitors?
When you ask that question, Judge, yes, that question has been asked. That question has been presented in many ways. The federal government spent over $1 billion on wasted efforts. There was a project in the FBI called the Virtual Case File, which was like $800 or $300-something million. Then there was another project called the Sentinel Project, which was another
$800. I'm aware of that.
Yeah. And so, you know, those kind of – when you have that kind of money on the table and then you have a small company that comes along who can offer the federal government – now, mind you, the federal government contacted IRP Solutions. At the time, in 2004 time frame, you know, the Department of Homeland Security was still a new organization. They needed to answer to Congress. They needed to be able to say, Yes, we have wheels in motion to ensure that another 9/11 does not happen. And they reached out to IRP Solutions. IRP Solutions presented a quote for over $100 million to the Department of Homeland Security for one component of an 18-module software solution. $100 million.
I'd say follow the money. I'd say follow the money because what's happened here is so bizarre. I mean, it really is so bizarre. I mean, the Tenth Circuit not getting the request, the arguments, whatever. It's so bizarre. A normal person says, who does that? Who says that? What's wrong with these people? It's an absurd, abject disorder of reality. Nobody takes that on its face, at least no right-minded person.
Wow.
No.
They shake their head and they go, what's wrong with these people? I mean, come on. Get it together. I mean, I have to say follow the money because there's a competitor somewhere who's got or who was behind in making the product who needed them out of the way.
Well, to answer your question before about who are the competitors, we're talking billion-dollar corporations like SAIC.
Oh, I know we are.
Lockheed Martin. So there's your answer.
Well, I think there is our answer. you start where the outside influences are.
Or a conglomerate thereof. I mean, and you know what's interesting about this case as well is just like yourself, you reviewed certain aspects of the case. Other folks outside of the Tenth Circuit have reviewed the case. We've had other guests on the program, Judge H. Lee Sarakin, retired federal judge, a retired appellate judge. Yeah, and Judge Sarakin wrote a 5-piece series in the Huffington Post about this case, about the transcript.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, how can the Tenth Circuit not get it right? I mean, they ruled against themselves. Judge Willick, I mean, in the appellate brief, the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals used the Larson case against the IRP 6. In another case, they ruled in favor of the defendant and granted the appeal using the exact same case, the exact same language.
Do you know what that's called? Ping-ponging. In other words, you use something. Let me just give you an example. In a case I was in, the Department of Justice argued one argument one way before the Department of Justice. Same DOJ attorney, same office, same branch. The same attorney then went to the Ninth Circuit and argued the opposite argument. Mm-hmm. It's they ping-pong the courts. And what they're doing, basically, is a fraud upon the court. They're trying to buy time. They are doing whatever they can for their own agenda, which is not entirely fleshed out to us as clear as we'd like it to be. But there is another agenda here, and it starts with other people. Now, you could say, what is the judge's agenda here? Well, sure, no judge likes to be overturned, but not to this point. I mean, she's not only going to be overturned, but, I mean, she might get asked to be removed from the bench. I mean, this is serious stuff.
Oh, it is serious.
And
it's very serious. Judge Bullock, we have a caller. Let's go to the phones. Caller, are you there? You have a question or comment?
Yes, I am. I have a comment for the judge. I have such an appreciation for the fact that the first thing you said was there's a competitor. Now, the guys, these six, IRP six, sit down with the former Wellington Webb mayor of Denver, and he listened to this whole thing, what had happened to these guys. And the first thing he said was, this is a competitor that did this to these guys.
I think they were set up as well. And it goes all the way through the judicial system. As it happens, you know that.
Yes.
I'm not coloring every judge as being corrupt, but I am saying the judiciary is corrupt.
Yeah.
What corrupts the judiciary? Money and power. Where does that money and power come from? The outside.
That's right.
I can believe that. That is so refreshing to hear you say that, because not one other person that's been on this show has been so forthcoming as you are. And if that's not refreshing, and
to me it was obvious.
And you say it with such confidence, and that, hey, this is what's happening. Have you thought about that? And so
to me it was
addressed,
very, very obvious. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just so obvious. And so when people are looking around saying, well, what happened? How could this happen? Somebody got paid very well. And that's why it happened. So I do appreciate your comments tonight. I just wanted to call in and let you know I appreciate that.
You're very kind. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for the call. And and that is true, Judge Bullock. There was a meeting with the former mayor of Denver, along with other members of the Chamber of Commerce in Denver and the Black Chamber and so forth. And that is a comment that the former mayor of Wellington Webb made. He also made another comment that U.S. Attorney John Walsh in Denver was a fair man and reached out to him and so forth and so on. And that fell flat from the standpoint that when the IRP6 did reach out to him, had a proffer that spelled out to the T what IRP Solutions was doing, how they were conducting business. They even signed, one of those agreements with the Justice Department that if you see that we're lying in any way in this proffer, then we will suffer the consequences. You know,
oh, that's such a joke.
Oh.
Those memorandums of understanding, that's a joke. I mean, I'm sorry. Because, I mean, the thing is, do you think that they are bread and butter to each other? And there's no way. That's like the EEOC saying to the Department of Justice, the Office of Special Counsel, that they've signed a memorandum of understanding that they will actually come in and mandate what punishment the RMOs should have that have discriminated and retaliated. And, you know, I'll laugh for decades to come, because do you think that will ever happen? It's never happened to date, and it's been a law for decades. So, come on. If they haven't been doing it for decades, why do they need another memorandum of understanding? To remind themselves? I don't think so.
Yeah. Well, in IRP 6 case, what happened there is the U.S. attorney never came back to the guys and said, oh, you're lying. They never acknowledged it.
Do you think they'll ever do that? Never do that.
Do you know
how much courage it takes?
There you go. It goes back to what Wayne was saying as far as accountability. It takes someone like yourself, Your Honor, to stand up and say, okay, the law should be about this, 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 and this. I've taken an oath from a professional conduct perspective, from an ethical perspective,
right,
that I will uphold the oath, I will uphold the Constitution. But until people, that really is what they're about, like you say, it takes a lot of courage. Well, it doesn't take courage. I think you just got to do what's right.
Right.
Well, you know what happened to me, right? That as a federal EEOC judge, I was asked by the chairwoman to change a decision that was 65 pages long that I had found in favor of two women attorneys who worked for the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission. As a matter of fact, she was so hot to try to do it that I had to leave the hospital after ovarian surgery, cancer surgery, within 24 hours, go by ambulance, get to the office, and find out after three supervising judges and my director pounced on me and said, this needs to be changed, that I looked at them and said, I read the mission statement. We're to eradicate all vestiges of discrimination. I don't change decisions. Not for you, not for anyone, not for any reason. And I'm sorry, but I'm going back to the hospital. And they, the next 4 to 5 years that I stayed as a judge, they made my life a living hell.
But the reality was,
I refused to do it. I said, I'm not doing that. I don't have to do that. And I won't do it. Now, I could have been very political and said, excuse me, but, you know, I'm on too many drugs. Well, I was on a lot of drugs, but I still knew my ethics. I mean, I didn't lose my ethics along the way.
The few, the very few.
Wow, that is commendable. I mean,
it is.
To be strong-armed, if you will, by the judiciary, by your, quote, peers. And by
the chairwoman herself.
Wow.
Wow.
That is disappointing to hear.
Judge, we're all sitting here looking at each other with our mouths kind of just dropped. You know, that is amazing to hear the behind-the-scenes an account of a situation from behind the scenes as to what could happen in a case. So, you know, when people, you know that people accuse a Just Cause, they accuse the IRP6 of being conspiracy theorists and so forth. But like you said, Judge, you know, follow the money. Follow, you know, there are other things that go. I mean, look at the situation, Wayne, where we talk about Judge Arguello going into the jury room after she had thanked the jury for their service, but then she says, you know, but wait for me in the jury room. I want to just thank you again in person. And Judge Bullock, after that situation, none of the jurors would speak about the case. As a matter of fact, one of the jurors, when they were contacted by, a post-trial analyst to just do a post-trial interview, contacted the FBI.
Well, they're not supposed to. The judge had no right to say to them, don't speak to anyone. I mean, because lawyers typically will send people out to inquire as to why they decided the way they did. You know, we can't get into what happened in the jury room, but, you know, that's why when they come in, they personally say yay or nay. And afterwards, you know, you do go and interview them to find out what was it that was the deciding factor for them.
And, you know, we get it, you know, as far as it's an individual juror's prerogative as to whether or not they want to speak to anyone. Now, you know, given it under those conditions, mm-hmm. understandable. If someone says, hey, I'm done with it, I don't have anything to say, you know, what I said as far as, yeah, that was my vote in the courtroom, great. But when they say, I was told by the judge to call the U.S. Attorney's mm-hmm. office or call the FBI, And one of them, oh,
yes, very
something
wrong.
Is very wrong about that.
That's what I said. There's an amalgam of peculiar circumstances which you cannot get past. I think that's one of the reasons the United States Supreme Court took this case quickly from their conference, deciding that this was a case to docket. Because you cannot have our courtrooms run amok. They cannot be ruled by individual judges on their own agenda. You know, they are sworn to uphold the United States Constitution. And the Constitution is very, very clear about the Fifth Amendment. And due process, come on. You know, I mean, nobody talks about due process, but due process is an issue here, you know.
It's dirty from top to bottom. One of the mm-hmm. follow-up questions I have for you on your statement that the judiciary is corrupt, what can we do to clean up the judiciary and restore it to its former glory?
Former glory?
Well, I think that
I was taught about that you know what I mean? I grew up believing. Oh,
I do know.
I'm sorry.
I do know because I grew up in believing in that too. But I would say that, you know, there has to be a house cleaning and a real paradigm shift in what we as citizens will accept and not accept and force that belief upon our public servants that as public servants, they have a duty above all other duties to have a fair and just system. You know, it doesn't mean that we will always find the truth out because we have too many exceptions to the law to always get to the truth, like husband-wife exceptions where one can't testify against the other. But, you know, to find justice is our pursuit. Now, I understand what it means to be an advocate, but as I say in my book, one of the last blood sports in America is litigation. Come on, it's like in the Coliseum. What counts as the last man standing in the pool of blood over your, you know, your opposing counsel? And you got to make sure he's not just down for the market share, but that he is down, period. You know?
Wow.
And it is serious today.
Yes.
Yeah.
Win at any cost. It doesn't matter.
That's right. By any means possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Judge Billick, we have another caller that we want to bring on. Have a question or comment. Caller, are you there? Okay, no caller. All right, we thought we had another caller there, but at any rate, and you make a good point, Judge Bullock, as far as the winning at any cost, and that's one of those things that it should not. We had a guest on once, and used sort of the same analogy, and the guest said that it should not be about someone walking out of the courtroom and being like Rocky running up the steps in Philadelphia with his hands up in the air saying, you know, we are the champions of the world. And, you know,
it should not be.
Yeah, it shouldn't be about that. Okay, I think we got our caller back, so let's go to the phones. Caller, are you there?
Yes, Your Honor. I just called in a few minutes ago. Did I hear you say that you had surgery and left the hospital to go to the courtroom?
Yes, that's correct.
You are the most courageous woman I have ever heard of in my life.
I don't know if that was courageous. I felt I didn't have a choice. But, you know, what was I going to say? You know, I wasn't going to let them change it or do anything that, you know, when I wasn't there. But I went back to the hospital. Guess what? They did change it. And the thing I said before I left was, if you change this and I come back and find out, I'm going to call these women and let them know that they should sue the United States government, and I will testify on their behalf.
I love your courage. It takes really a courageous person to stand up with full knowledge that they're going to put me through a living hell as a result of standing up for what I believe is right. And I know that, but I'm going to do it anyway. You're just my kind of woman. I love you.
Oh, thank you.
Awesome.
Wow. And
I paid. Trust me.
Well, let me ask this question, Your Honor.
Thanks again, caller.
Did those women sue, or was that the end?
No, they didn't. I guess, you know, first of all, I mean, I didn't hear the case. My supervising judge heard, and it had been on his desk for 7 years. Well, you know, if I had a trial, I'd be wondering where my decision was, too. And so when I left, there's something to the saying that no good deed goes unpunished. So mm-hmm. when I was going to the hospital at Cedars-Sinai waiting for a bed, I said, is there any work that you need that I could help you catch up on? And I took that case. I said, do you have any memory of this? Do you take any notes? Did you do anything? He goes, no. He said, just do it according to the evidence. And we put 13 boxes in my small car. And I drove home, and I took a week finishing it, waiting for a bed for surgery. And that's what I said, no good deed goes unpunished. I found in favor of the women attorneys, racial discrimination, national origin, and violations of the Equal Pay Act. And I'll tell you, you know, they reversed everything. And even when they did it so quickly and they were under so much pressure that even their grammar was bad. I mean, I go, who wrote this?
Wow. We've seen that before.
Yeah.
With cut and paste.
Yeah, that's true. Decisions. That's true. In the IRP 6 case, I mean, it was cut and paste stuff out of other decisions. And like you said, the ping pong, I'm going to remember that, or the pong effect. And so, Judge Bullock, as far as your radio program and some of the other advocacy work that you're doing, how can folks follow you, keep in contact with you, reach out to you?
Well, I have a book, Judging Me, which is on childhood sexual abuse. As a child, I was violently sexually abused for 10-plus years, tortured, and then sold into child sex slavery, and became a very well-known federal civil rights judge. It was a very arduous journey. From child to adulthood.
10 years?
Sorry, for 10 plus years. That's correct.
Wow.
And my book, The Profits, the proceeds go to help abused children and survivors of child abuse. And I would just, it is one of the most endemic pandemic problems we have today, between CDC and WHO and other various organizations who have studied this. It's, people don't want to look at it. It's one of those kinds of things where people would prefer to look away than to deal with the reality of it. But it's well and alive. Just like the race issue, it's alive and well.
It's alive and well.
It is. It
it's
absolutely
more elastic. It's just more elastic today.
People stick their head in the sand and pretend it doesn't exist, but it exists. And I'm sure you heard us talking, and you probably know about the case in Utah with the young man, Darian Hunt, who was shot.
Right.
And from a biracial mother, a mother who's white, father who's black. And, you know, I ask the question now that you have another young black man shot down in the streets, but no one expected that his white mother would be the face on the screen saying, "You killed my son because he's black."
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think that brings it to a whole new reality right there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it does, because the racial issue is elastic today. You know, and I think people just, you know, it comes back to what is wrong with people's biases and prejudices. I thought we got rid of those. I thought we fought, you know, the wars. I thought we had legislation. I mean, it is not okay for a person to say, well, I'm better than my grandfather. At least I don't say this. I don't use those words. Well, I mean, who has the right to say I'm better than? I mean, you know, I mean, what is wrong with you? You know, I believe I was gifted in a way that I am colorblind. I've been that way my whole life. I was probably too busy waiting for my father to come and bash something on my head. But the reality is, you know, people to me are glorious in all ways. And so I don't understand being, you know, biased and prejudiced. I really don't. I don't understand how people can do that. All I know is that when I see it, it is so wrong that I have to say something. I mean, sometimes I've had to get up in the middle of a dinner and leave. Say I have to use the restroom and use $100 to take a taxi home. Say, I'm done with you.
Well, Judge Bullock, we need a lot more people on the bench like you. We need a lot more people in the legal profession like you, and we are certainly appreciative that you took time out of your schedule to join us. Now, I don't know what your schedule is like, but you're welcome to stay on with us as we move on. We have another guest that we're going to bring on, and you're more than welcome to stay on with us.
Thank you.
Okay, yes, all right. We'll leave your mic open as well, so if you want to chime in on our next guest. Our next guest is Mike Riley. He is a young documentary film producer, and he has a project called the USA, the Uninformed States of America. And Mike reached out to us via email to tell us about his film that he's working on. And you know, we took a look at the trailer. And one of the things that in his email, you know, being a young man, I don't know how old Mike is. I think he's in his early 20s. But he said that he has been encouraged by things that are going on with A Just Cause. He had been listening to A Just Cause radio, and this type of programming encourages him. And so let's bring Mike on and talk about how his project ties into not only getting involved, but then how it also ties into reforming our judicial process. Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing really well. Thank you so much for having me on. You know, it's a pleasure.
And Mike, you know, I have to say that you know, seeing the trailer of your documentary and the way you did the man on the street thing, you know, going up to people, and it's sad to say that we do truly live in an uninformed states of America.
That's right.
And so tell us a little bit about your project.
Sure thing. Basically, you know, this project, you know, basically what we're doing is we wanted to kind of highlight an area of the American democratic, you know, system that we feel isn't necessarily working, that a lot of people aren't necessarily shining a whole lot of light on. You know, we hear a million different ways from a million different politicians, you know, all the time, speaking about different ways to kind of, you know, jumpstart democracy. How can we get democracy to work properly? In my opinion, democracy will never work properly without fully informed and active citizens. And that's just one thing we're definitely lacking here in the United States on a huge level. You know, as you know, the midterm elections are coming up in a couple weeks here. And this is traditionally the time when a lot of Americans get bit by the apathy bug, so to speak. And, you know, we get really, really, really low turnouts. And those low turnouts usually start this kind of cultural spiral effect. It's something that we really noticed in the film, one of the areas that we were researching. And we just really want to know why. You know, what is it that makes us not want to get engaged? What is it about our judicial system? What is it about our legal system? What is it about our entire political system as a whole, our government system as a whole, that, you know, keeps a lot of Americans from wanting to get involved? So that's pretty much what the project's about. You know, we're out there trying to explore, and we're going to answer all those heated and controversial questions surrounding political apathy and ignorance in the United States.
So, Judge Bullock, what do you think about a young man like this launching out there and asking some of the tough questions?
I think I wish you would have been in my political science classes, my peace and justice studies, and some of my constitutional law classes.
Right, exactly. It's actually funny you mention that. I talked to a lot of different academics, a lot of political science professors. I actually spoke to one political science psychologist, in a sense, where he was a political psychologist, and he was kind of highlighting to me the different types of, you know, mentalities that we develop based upon our cultural dynamic in this country. Even you being a judge yourself, you know, I talk to a lot of my fellow friends, and, you know, they always ask me questions about the judicial system. You know, how is it that, you know, we get stuck with this particular judge, or how is it that we get stuck with this particular sheriff, or, you know, and these types of things. And a lot of people really don't know. They have no idea that, you know, our judges are elected, our sheriffs are elected, a lot of our higher courts, our superior courts, and our appeals courts are appointed by our governors and by a lot of people that we elect to office. And these are people that are supposed to be representing our best interests. And so many people are, especially my age, and the millennials, I'm using my quote fingers here, the 18 to 30 crowd, they are very, very not only ignorant but apathetic. And I don't mean this in a negative sense. I mean it completely in the positive sense. Not in the positive sense, but ignorant in the sense where they are not very informed, nor do they care to get informed. So, like I said, you know, we really want to know why. If democracy truly is, you know, the answer to if getting involved is truly the answer to making democracy work, then why is it that a lot of people just choose not to? And there's a several array of answers, of course, that we're looking to cover.
And, you know, Mike, several years back when President Obama was running for office the first time, cited that was the largest turnout of young adults in the country,
right,
as far as the election was concerned. Through
right.
your research that you're doing for your film, and I'm kind of, you know, just going off of a little bit of what I saw in the trailer, where some
Absolutely.
Folks couldn't even say, you know, who the Speaker of the House is.
Right.
Have you found level of activity in the younger age bracket, has that tapered off?
Not necessarily. I tend to look at certain political contests, especially the bigger ones like the presidential elections and things like that. You know, America, we're especially our younger generation, we're really a pop culture society. You know, if something is trending, if something is popular, if something is famous, if something is new, you know, young people, especially if it's a cause, will get behind it. Unfortunately, I think for a lot of us, and I don't know if this is 100% true or not, you know, this is something I'm researching in my documentary. It seems like our need for instant gratification or our attention spans seem to be dwindling a little bit. Like you said, in 2008, Barack Obama was popular. He was huge. He was, you know, the most famous guy in the world. And so, you know, it was natural for a lot of us to get behind it. A lot of young people, you know, we were coming out of the Bush years, and this was a breath of fresh air. It was our first black president, and there were all these exciting things. And then, and you know, and if you listen to Barack Obama speak, he was saying, you know, we need your help, we need you to go out there and you know, and keep us going in Congress. We need you to go out there and vote. And in 2010, as you know, that did not happen. We had those same people that came out and voted in 2008 completely sat out for those 2010 midterm elections. And we had a record low turnout. It was about 34% of the overall population, if I'm not mistaken. And those same people that went out and were, you know, gung-ho about voting for Barack Obama had no clue about what else they were voting for. All they know is the president. So they have no clue who the Speaker of the House is. They have no clue who their U.S. senators are, who their representatives are, who their local and state their governors are, or anything else. All they know is the president. And as far as they're concerned, he is the only, for a lot of people in my age category, he's the only thing that matters as far as the government is concerned. So in other words, if there's a problem, it's the president's fault. If something's happening, it's always the president's fault. I'm not saying that the president or the executive branch of government doesn't share some level of responsibility, but a lot of people are unaware that we have a Congress. But I just don't think they really know or care to know that, you know, our midterm elections are just as important, if not as important, as our presidential elections. I think the popularity and the hype that surrounds certain things can motivate people to want to get up and get involved. But, you know, congressional elections just aren't as fun. They're not as popular, although they're equally, if not, as more important.
Go ahead, Wayne.
I was just going to say, you were talking about the millennials. I'm in the generation X, I guess. And I see the same amount of apathy and disinterest in the political system. And I can tell you, I've been voting for 22 years now. And
you're so old, you don't remember, right?
Yeah, well, I just remember being 18 and so excited to go in and register to vote. And now it is an obligation. I do it because I think of all the folks that fought for me to have the right to vote. But for the most part, I figure garbage in, garbage out. And I'm rarely excited about a candidate.
And, you know, Mike, I'm looking at your press release, and it says here that there is a rather cynical approach to government by most Americans due to the corruption embedded within the fabric of American politics and the overall voting process. This has left many, mainly our younger voters, feeling government has very little effect on them, so there is no reason to get involved. You know, that's a sad assessment of the state of affairs, man.
Yeah, then when you look at the I was thinking about, as you guys were talking, when you think about the parties, it's the younger generation is like, who's out there? I mean, everybody that's talking, they're lying. I mean, it's like, you know, what are they doing for me?
What's the difference?
You know, what's happening? So it's really, if I vote for this one or that one, does it really matter? And so a lot just takes the stance of, I won't vote at all.
Exactly.
And of course, that hurts. But, you know, that's the way it seems to me. It seems as though, I mean, if you don't have anything to vote for that you think is going to do something for you as an individual or this country, why vote?
And Mike, I got to say, you know, I think what you have a team of folks that are working on this with you and a few, I don't know if they're students that are in school with you or what the deal is, but our listeners, I know I'm encouraged by the fact that a young man like Mike Riley.
That is good.
I mean, you sound like you're the real deal. I mean, like you do your homework, you do your research, and you're getting involved.
Thank you very much.
And so, you know, and like I said, we were all encouraged by your email that you sent in. So, Mike, what's your next step? What stage are you at in the production of your film? And what can we do? What can our listeners do to help you?
Absolutely. Well, thank you for asking. Basically, right now, in the stage of the film that we're at, we're trying to obviously create awareness around what we're trying to do. We launched a campaign where we're, you know, looking for donations. Obviously, we're looking for funding so that way we can take the rest of the film to the next, to the next level to get it out to as much of the masses as we possibly can. But right now, we're in the phase where we're really trying to build up awareness around this topic to as many people as we can. You can go to the film website. The film website is www.theusafilm.com. And there you can join up. We launched a Kickstarter page, which is going to end pretty soon. I don't think we're really going to reach our goal there, but it's no big deal because we're going to relaunch and we're going to do another campaign, and we can really use the help from, you know, the entire public. You know, I really stress the idea, like you said, this isn't a partisan type of documentary or film. I'm not trying to lean left or right. This is something I really truly think affects every single American. And so every single American, I think, is something that we should, you know, use to try to get them involved. So this film is one of those platforms that we're trying to use to really, you know, open up awareness about this. So for all your listeners, you know, go to the website, once again, www.theusafilm.com. Join the mailing list. Drop me an email. I'll answer any questions. Please go on the Kickstarter page and you know, if you can make a pledge, tell your friends about it. Spread the trailer. I know everybody out there has a Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, the whole nine yards. You know, use it to your advantage.
You know, Mike,
really help us spread awareness about this film. That'd be great. Yeah.
And you know, to your point, judicial injustice and corruption has no party affiliation. So, you know,
Absolutely. We
understand where you're coming from. So, Judge Bullock, do you have any words of wisdom for the young man?
You know, I just wanted to say, Mike, you know, you're remarkable.
Thank you.
At your ability to grasp these policy issues and to be able to articulate what is happening is really quite remarkable. And also, when you said something about that they feel the judicial corruption, et cetera, but that the government doesn't affect them because it's because of the corruption, it affects them. I mean, do you know how the government controls every single facet of our life? So the corruption,
absolutely.
It does affect them. That's why they have to get involved. It's not because the government doesn't affect them, that the government controls every aspect of their life. Seriously. If they could understand that, to see what, if you had a small business, the number of government agencies you would have to deal with would be mind-boggling.
Absolutely. And, you know, and that's another thing we highlight in the documentary is, you know, the system isn't simple. It is complex. And it does take some research, and it does take you having to pay attention. And it's going to take a lot of reform in order to get it to the point where we want to get it to. But be that as it may, I don't necessarily see that. And I'm not blaming the citizens on this. This is something of government responsibility, too, when it comes to civic education and motivation of its citizens. But I'm like, you know, we highlight in the film, you know, government isn't a spectator sport. It's not something you can just sit back on the sidelines and just watch and have things happen to you versus you doing something about something. You know, whether we like it or not, you are a part of government. And so you might as well get involved. It's
exactly.
Benefit all of us. So
right.
It doesn't matter whether you get involved or not. Things are going to, policy is going to take place. So your best bet, it would be in everybody's best interest just to be involved anyway. So that's something that we're definitely showcasing in the film. And so, yeah, you're right. Well, thank you, Judge. I appreciate
support
that.
You know, Mike's closing words there, everyone needs to get involved. I think that's fitting for tonight's program. Everyone needs to get involved.
Enough is enough.
There you go. There you go.
Right.
So Mike Riley, film producer of documentary film, The USA, The Uninformed States of America. Mike, thanks for joining the program.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. The Honorable Judge Mary E. Bullock. Judge Bullock, thanks for joining us as well. Gosh,
you're welcome.
Truly, truly appreciate,
appreciate
what you had to say tonight and your stand for justice. We appreciate that. So folks can go out to our websites, justcause.com. Again, that's www.a-justcause.com. Get more information about our organization. For archives of the interview with Judge Bullock as well as Mike Riley and with Gina McGill, who wrote the book on the Trayvon Martin case, you can go out to ajcradio.com. Again, ajcradio.com for 24/7 programming of A Just Cause. You can go to live365.com. On Sunday mornings, you can tune in to Progressive Radio Network, and that's at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time. You can catch us there, and you can get there by going to prn.fm. We ask that you like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. This is the Just Cause Coast to Coast. We bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. So we invite you to tune in, listen to us every Tuesday and Thursday right here on Blog Talk Radio. from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. At the top of the program, we talked about the situation with the Fifth Amendment violation of the IRP-6, as well as other violations, you know, expert witnesses not being allowed to testify, speedy trial violation.
Yes.
And, gosh, Judge Bullock, she articulated it so well. It's like, what is going on in the 10th Circuit? It's like, you know, you don't have to be, you can be blind and see that something is wrong here.
Right.
So especially with that Fifth Amendment violation, wow, and the missing transcript, we got a petition out there on change.org. Go out to change.org, do a search on IRP6, sign the petition. Ask your friends and family to sign it. For more information about the IRP6, go to freetheirp6.org. The IRP6 are Gary Walker, David Banks, Dave Zerpolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, and Demetrius Harper. Please keep our brothers in prayer. They have been wrongly incarcerated now for over 2 years. We still have a campaign going on where we are trying to get Attorney General Eric Holder to launch an investigation in this case. Dennis, how can folks help out there?
Yeah, we need everybody to make a phone call. Call Eric Holder's office and let him know, you know, what you feel. The number is 202-514-2003 or 202-514-2005. Get a hold of Eric Holder's office and tell him, hey, we need you to investigate the IRP case now.
And then the jurors, we touched on it just a moment ago, Wayne. What right, can jurors do here?
Well, we're asking the jurors in the IRP 6 case to call us at 855-529-4252. As we talked about, expert witness testimony withheld. When the jurors asked if there was any additional evidence that they could go through, they were lied to and told no. They were visited by the judge after the case and told not to speak with us. So if you want the full story, give us a call, 855-529-4252. That'll get you someone at a Just Cause.
And we want to say thank you again to all of our guests who were on the program. Gina McGill, who wrote the book, The State of Florida versus Trayvon Martin. The Honorable Judge Mary E. Bullock, who has, you know, she's been on the bench. You got to hear the archives to hear all the things she talked about. This, I mean, she's one of a kind. And so
definitely,
we truly appreciate her.
Great interview.
Also, Mike Riley, film producer. His film, The Uninformed States of America. People need to go out there and support that. We'd like to say thank you to our production team for all the work that they do. Captain Kyle and Dustin, Ilskilla's girl. Y'all are waiting on me to mess that up again. Also to our research team, and then to Olivia, Miss Barbara, as well as Gloria. To the truth. As Cliff would say, we know you're out there.
Right.
And we know that you're pulling for us. We appreciate all the that you provide us in helping us out there. Go to AJC, to the AJC website or prweb.com. Check out the latest press releases regarding the IRP6 case. And then also, like I said, you know, in the absence of Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, Lamont Banks, they're away taking care of business, and so we appreciate everything they're doing there. We ask that you would also check us out at our website. Click the donate button. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman for Wayne Wright and Dennis Merritt. Good night, America.
Good night.
Good night.